It's KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. We take it for granted that freedom is a good thing, that democracy makes life better. But how does that work exactly? And really, how is democracy doing? Mark Lagon is president of Freedom House, and he joins us this morning on the phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Mark, good morning and welcome.
It's great to be with you, and I'll be traveling there soon to be speaking at William Jewell College, and I'm delighted to be with you.
Yes, we'll definitely give the details of that Thursday evening and Friday morning. Mark's giving some lectures up at William Jewell. You know, some of our listeners may be familiar with the work of Freedom House, but others may not be. What is Freedom House, Mark?
Freedom House is an international nonprofit that focuses on human rights and democracy. It actually was founded in 1941 to urge the American people to get into World War II to take on the biggest human rights threat and international aggressive threat in the world at the time, the Nazi Germany. We're most famous for our reports on human rights around the world, press freedom, and internet freedom, where we give grades to all countries around the world on their efforts to keep up those standards.
Right. So if people go to your website, they can see a map of the world that says shows countries that are free, countries that are partly free, and countries that are not free.
That's right. Since 1972, we've been using the same standards for assessing all countries on their political rights and civil liberties. And it's an elaborate methodology where we get scholars to look at it. But we do boil the world down into these three categories to focus the mind about those countries that are living up to our basic values, but also, you know, or threats to prosperity and stability because of human rights abuses.
So the lecture you're giving at William Jewell on Thursday night is called The Global Democracy Recession, Can We Recover? What do you mean by a global democracy recession?
Well, for 10 years in a row in Freedom House's Freedom in the World survey, more nations have been declining in their political rights and civil liberties than they've been improving. A lot of those are small changes. A lot of the biggest changes are among the most bloodthirsty autocracies in the world getting worse. But in 2015, 72 countries in the world declined in their political rights and civil liberties as compared to 43 improving. And it's the first time in the 44 years of our report that for 10 years in a row, more countries have been going in the wrong direction.
So can you give us an example? Oh, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Can you give us an example of what that looks like, going the wrong direction? Give us an example, maybe not of one of those terrible autocracies, but of a country that just takes a small step in the wrong direction.
Well, I'll give you a country in the news. Turkey is doing a good job to try and deal with the situation of a mass of Iraqi and Syrian refugees coming into its country. But over the last few years under the leadership of Erdogan, press freedoms have been declining. Internet freedom has been controlled by the government. Dissent has been squeezed, and hopes for an Islamist government, a government associated with a fundamentalist strain of Islam, have not turned out well in terms of religious freedom. That's one place we're worried about, and one of the places of the last 10 years that's actually declined.
Let's play out this metaphor of recession, as you call it, a little further. If the democracy is in a recession now, or if the idea of democracy is, when were the boom years, when were the bust years, as you see it? That you said the last 10 years have seen more decline than improvement. It used to be better?
Yeah, the political scientist, the late Samuel Huntington, referred to the third wave of democratization in the world. Between Portugal becoming a democracy in the mid-1970s and the post-Cold War era, there was a big movement towards more countries having elections and improving. And so through the 1990s, there was a real strong improvement, and one saw this actually in lots of Eastern European countries joining NATO and the European Union living up to those standards, but all over the world. There continue to be more and more democratic elections, but freedom means much more than holding elections. The elections need to be fair and free, and basic freedoms, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, and minorities and women having, you know, full rights being protected, that's been sliding in recent years.
So I imagine this is a complicated answer, but to what do you attribute this decline, this steady decrease in democracy over the course of a decade?
Well, there was hope for civil society organizing itself to push governments to reform, to change autocratic governments, or to hold, fledgling democracies to account, to keep reforming. But there have been some trailblazers in using methods to squeeze civil society. Russia, China, Iran, even Saudi Arabia have developed ways of limiting civil society, making outside funding for those groups illegal, squeezing press freedoms. And those are getting copied by countries around the world.
So you're saying that countries like China have been influential on other countries?
Yeah. You talk about best practices. Well, there's some evil practices that Russia, China, and some of these other countries that have, you know, set up laws to make it hard for nonprofits like we have in the United States to register and to get help from outside, limiting freedom of association, assembly, sort of controlling the press and the internet. So the playbook is coming from Russia or China, even if it isn't repression that they themselves are putting in place.
So I guess that begs the question then, on the other side of the scale, has the United States stopped being a positive or influential force for democratic values, or is it just less influential than it used to be? What's happened?
Well, the United States has had, through Republican and Democratic administrations, a way that it's placed supporting democracy very centrally in its foreign policy. The Bush administration is criticized for perhaps associating that too closely with the invasion of Iraq, and it didn't appear to be a success there, nor in Afghanistan. President Obama has been ambivalent about the goal of promoting democracy around the world. I think he feels that we need to deal with some nasty dictators in various places, whether it be Iran's leadership or Cuba. Many would criticize him for that. But in a piece that I put out in the Wall Street Journal in January, I said that the United States and Europe are less clear leaders on this. I don't think it's because we have less influence. I think it's uncertainty and lack of will.
And it sounds like you're blaming the Obama administration for a lot of this change.
Well, I think this is a shared responsibility. Republicans, too, have been unwilling to fund democracy assistance and are a little uncertain of the kind of legacies that Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush embraced. So there's shared responsibility for this. But I think the United States needs to get itself off the psychiatrist's couch. It still remains a substantial leader in the world. And what it has to offer is generally positive, especially if it works with other Western countries. There are signs, glimmers of hope out there, despite this democracy recession, if you want to talk about that.
Well, I certainly do want to talk about that. I know that you worked in the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, from 2007 to 2009. You were U.S. ambassador at large. You directed the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. And I want to talk about human trafficking here in a moment. But I guess I wonder if there isn't a tension between sort of the ideals that you want the United States to stand for and the pragmatic of making them work on a day-to-day basis. Is that what administrations, Republican or Democratic, are finding themselves up against? Is that why it's hard to exert leadership?
It's a great question. And I think you know, the sort of last resort for promoting democracy is by invasion. And we did a really good job in Germany and Japan after World War II, but you don't want to have to resort to that. And so, you know, the Iraq invasion is not necessarily the best way, most effective way to do it. But, you know, there's a bargain out there. Assistance to civil society actors and journalists around the world fighting for themselves for reform is not only a kind of, you know, moral imperative for us to stick with those dissidents, but in fact, you know, it works in a budget tight environment in Washington. It's actually a bargain.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the work you did specifically as the director of the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. In fact, your Friday morning lecture at William Jewell, the second lecture you're giving this week, is about what diplomacy can and can't do about human trafficking. So bring us up to speed. What is the state of human trafficking today?
Well, human trafficking is essentially contemporary slavery. You know, it's where certain groups of people, whether they be women, children, migrants, people of lower caste in India, are not given access to justice. And whether it be sexual exploitation, sexual slavery, or child labor or forced labor, it's modern slavery. It often involves people migrating across borders, but it's not the migration which is the key, it's the exploitation. We've learned a great deal about it. In fact, Governor Brownback, when he was a senator, worked with one of the most left-tilted senators at the time, Paul Wellstone, on legislation in the year 2000 to fight human trafficking. That Trafficking Victims Protection Act set up an office at the State Department that, and this should sound familiar, gives grades to other countries, and it's gotten them to change over time.
You wrote in the Washington Post that human trafficking generates $99 billion of, trade or commerce every year. Where all is that happening, and how are we talking about that much money?
Well, the reason why human trafficking is booming and being turned to by international criminals and small fry exploiters is that the payoff is more and the chances of punishment is less compared to other forms of international crime, including people turning to it from drug trafficking. People ask me, where is the problem the worst in the world? There are three ways to answer that question. One is South Asia, because the big bulge in the number of victims is in India and in South Asia, where people who are in lower castes are in bonded labor, whether in a rice mill, a brick kiln, or a brothel, as a child trafficking victim. If you want to know where there's both sex trafficking and labor trafficking, the worst place is East Asia and Southeast Asia, because it's got both problems aplenty in a place like Cambodia. But the place that's the most, I think, acute problem for human trafficking is the Gulf. In the Gulf states, women and migrant workers, oftentimes legal guest workers, are subject to the worst forms of human slavery.
And what is being done about it now? You're suggesting that not enough, or at least what's being done isn't effective. But what has been the response to human trafficking on the part of the international community?
Well, in the last 16 years, which is the time since the UN got a treaty, and perhaps more importantly, the U.S. passed the law that then Senator Brownback and Senator Wellstone authored. The United States has played a leading role raising awareness around the world about this and sort of giving tough love to other countries by putting out a report that ranks countries in four different tiers on how they're doing to fight the problem, and frankly threatening to deny foreign aid to those who are in the worst category. It's propelled countries to change. A Harvard scholar, Beth Simmons, and a Duke scholar, Judith Kelly, have found in their research that, in fact, that Trafficking in Persons report gets countries to change their laws. Unfortunately, even if they put in place a comprehensive law on human trafficking like the U.S. has, they have to implement it. And very often countries don't implement what they have on paper. And that's actually the problem of human rights around the world.
So when you speak of the limits of diplomacy, you're saying that the problem isn't getting laws on the books, it's actually getting countries to enforce them.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So can you give us an example?
Like
what country has sort of met the requirements to quit getting a bad grade in the report, but then not proceeded to actually implement the laws?
Well, take a couple of examples. Mexico and Nigeria. Mexico has passed a comprehensive law on human trafficking, but it hasn't actually gotten its law enforcement to focus on that problem as opposed to other crime. It hasn't had victim services, particularly if there are any men or people who are in labor trafficking as opposed to sex trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
Nigeria has its own sort of interagency bureau that deals with human trafficking, but there still needs to be actually coordination with, you know, like their labor ministry and their justice ministry to actually fight the problem day to day.
I know that you've been at Freedom House for just over a year. Obviously, you've worked on a number of these issues even before that. You mentioned the other reports that Freedom House produces, including on freedom of the press and freedom on the internet. Do you feel like access to information is actually improving around the world, that freedom as expressed through what we in this country would regard as First Amendment expressions is improving, or is that getting worse too?
Well, it's kind of counterintuitive for everybody who sees this information overload and, you know, is active on the internet to think that there's less information and less access to it. But we see around the world in our Freedom in the Press report that comes out every spring that there are more forms of censorship that governments are trying to implement, and there's sort of centralized ownership of large media entities that sometimes have cozy relationships with their government. Turkey, I mentioned earlier, that's an example of that. On internet freedom, it's not just governments that are trying to censor the internet, but in fact, technology is being used to pursue surveillance. And so privacy is a major consideration. A good example, look at China. Is it a better situation that more people have access to information on an internet that is censored by the government? Is it better than the situation was before? Or is it still a serious situation that, you know, if you want to look up Tiananmen Square, freedom, democracy, or those kinds of words, you're not going to find it in your Google search?
Because Google will limit what it shows to people in China.
Google has tried to do, you know, its best by giving people an opportunity to go on to the Hong Kong version of their search engine. But it is the Chinese government's policy to try and limit certain terms that you want to search for. And the most insidious thing is the use of social media to try and monitor people so that islands of dissent in countries from Saudi Arabia to China are kept, you know, have Big Brother watching.
Mm-hmm. I guess I wonder, what do you think is the most critical issue, the single biggest issue in global human rights today, as you see it, from the standpoint of someone whose whole job is to watch these things around the world?
Well, if you're looking at the diagnosis, we found in this decade of a recession of democracy that rule of law, which is the corruption, transparency, that kind of stuff, freedom of expression and freedom of assembly are the places where there's the biggest problems. But I'd say as a policy response, some old-fashioned leadership is what's needed. I sometimes feel like you ought to use the phrase, if not us, who? The United States still has a lot to offer to pull together the world's democracies, whether in Europe or some of the leading powers of what people call the Global South. We can't expect an India or a Brazil to be leaders on this if we don't push for it too. We need to stand up for these values, and it's very important to note that peace and economic growth will benefit from democracy. It's not just only about a moral case.
I guess I wonder what success looks like in this work of promoting democracy and freedom around the world. Is moving the needle a little bit, is that what counts for a good day's work? Is it turning that number from 72 countries in decline and 43 in ascent around? Or do you really imagine this to be more of a 50-year or 100-year or 500-year project?
I'm glad you asked. I mean, you know, if the goal is to rid the world of all autocracies, then it is decades long. But if there have been glimmers of hope, if you see how the international community put pressure on Sri Lanka to change or for Burma to change in recent years, and they've gone in the right direction. A leader in Sri Lanka, Mahinda Rajapaksa, was ousted by elections, and reforms have been taking place. In Burma, we see the party of Aung San Suu Kyi taking power and slow glimmers of hope. Nigeria put in place a new leader, Muhammadu Buhari, who replaced Goodluck Jonathan, taking on terrorism and corruption there. So the U.S. and others need to just stand by these countries and offer support, and the glimmers of hope may end up coalescing in a wave back of democracy.
That's Mark Lagon. He's former U.S. ambassador and now president of Freedom House. He joined us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. He'll be speaking on Thursday night and on Friday morning at William Jewell College. We'll link to information about those lectures he's giving there at our website, which is kcur.org. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate you having me on. Looking forward to coming.